Hi, my name's Juliet Davenport, and welcome to Great Green Questions. My day, as usual, has been really full, and so I am sitting here this evening walking the dogs in the dark. One of them's just tried to wipe me out with his stick. He is terribly proud of, but in the dark, I didn't actually see it coming, so he just whacked me over the head. Anyway, today I am talking about some of the issues we have with talking to our children about climate change and the environment.
Parenting is really hard in this challenging world, whether it's COVID and homeschooling, figuring out how much TV on online you should allow your kids, or whether it's walking the fine line between overwhelming them and empowering them related to things like climate change and the environment. We decided to do this panel about whether we need to be frank with our children about climate change. And in fact, we went out beforehand and asked people on social media whether they would send us their questions that they had been challenged by their own children. And there were some really interesting ones that came through. Does being an adult mean you stop caring about other people and nature? Really spot on question there. Will humans become extinct before I die? Wow, pretty powerful. And in fact, there were others where environmentalists actually said that their children were fed up about talking about climate change. So this week's Great Green Question is, do we actually need to be really frank when talking to our children about climate change? So today we have a great panel with a wide range of ages and experiences. Our first guest is Dr. Maya Rose Craig, also known as Bird Girl. She's been campaigning for racial equality and activism as a young person for years, and is an ornithologist and probably the youngest person to see half the world's bird species. That's pretty impressive. She also is the youngest person to be given an honorary doctorate, so she's pretty accomplished already. She shared the stage last year with my personal hero, Greta Thunberg, so I think she is well qualified to talk about this subject. Our second guest is Bobby Seagull. Now, a little bit of a personal hero because he's a maths teacher, a writer and a media star, somebody who has been trying to take maths to the masses and aspires to be the Jamie Oliver of the maths world. Bobby also writes the Financial Times. He's a UK Libraries champion, and he's found fame after his enthusiasm on the University Challenge, which is pretty impressive. And then finally, our comedian panelist this week is Andy Field. He's a comedian, writer, and star of his own Radio 1 show, The Andy Field Experience. And quite critically, also used to work for a major environmental charity. So he has a lot to say on these subjects to do with environmentalists. I must confess, this panel was particularly good for another reason, in that the technology completely let me down, leading to moments like this one.
Oh, Everybody's frozen.
You scared her off, Andy.
Is that me?
I know, I'm sorry. Are we done now? Is that... Yeah, good job.
The impact of climate change is done. It's reduced our energy.
It's the whole of the ozone sector up.
In spite of changing to three different locations in my house and recording on two different machines, me and my wonderful panel managed to get through where we all first learned about climate change and what age and what it meant to us. Maya Rose talked to us about her experience at the school strikes, eco-anxiety and what we can do to help children, the role of teachers and parents, and how do we walk the fine line between empowering and overwhelming. There is a little exciting moment with a Casio at the end in terms of the countdown. We also had a great time answering some of the lighter questions from the Twitter, but I don't want to give too much away before the curtains have opened. So enough from me, and over to today's show.
Juliet's
stunned. Oh, Juliet's gone. Juliet's
gone.
Well, she was
like,
being really thoughtful.
Done. That's a Bobby just.
I love how Bobby, you got half an opportunity and went, "I'll host. That's fine."
Don't worry, I'll take over.
Everybody's frozen.
You scared her off, Andy.
It's the whole of the ozone sector up.
Hi, everybody. My name's Juliet Davenport, and I'm an environmentalist, but I didn't really learn about climate change until I was at university studying atmospheric physics. So I never really had the experience of being a young child trying to think about climate change. Today, I'm a mother walking the line between not overwhelming my daughter and empowering her. So this week's big question is, Do we need to be frank when talking to children about climate change? I've got a fantastic panel here who are going to help me answer that question. I'm going to ask you all to introduce yourself. So, Maya Rose, I'm going to ask you to introduce yourself first.
Hi, I'm Maya Rose and I am a young environmental activist and campaigner. So I'm 18 and I've been doing this since I was about 12. And I also am half Bangladeshi and I do a lot of work to do with engaging our minority ethnic communities into nature and our environmental movement, basically.
Brilliant. And when did you first hear about climate change or learn about climate change?
I think that's a really difficult question to answer just because it's sort of been everywhere, literally for as long as I can remember. Like, this whole thing about the world ending is literally longer than I have any memory of. So it's always been a really big thing in my life. And I think it's the same for a lot of young people, which is why you get these massive things like Extinction Rebellion, like youth strikes.
And do you have an environmental confession? I mean, you skipped breakfast this morning because there wasn't any oat milk. You're obviously quite hardcore. Is there anything, though, that where you slip up a little from your environmental side?
Oh, there's loads of things. I really want to be vegan, but I also really like cheese. I own a car. I've been on a plane a few too many times. I am not a perfect environmentalist at all.
Well, that's wonderful. Thank you, Maya Rose, for that. Bobby, turn to you.
So my name is Bobby Seagull. I'm a school maths teacher, author of The Life-Changing Magic of Numbers, and a BBC presenter for the Monkman and Seagull's Genius Guides. And as a teacher, environment, climate change is one thing my students often ask me about. And during lessons, I'm often like, shh, get on with the fractions, but it's interesting and important playground conversation.
Yeah. And when did you first learn about climate change?
So in the sort of early mid-90s, I actually had a chat with my brother about this. So he entered a art competition, which is about the world, where it at. And he drew a black charcoal-based power station emitting pollution into the atmosphere. And it won the competition, and we've still got it at home somewhere. And I think that was at the time where global warming started becoming a phrase that was thrown about. So sort of early mid-90s, partly because of an art competition. And then since then, I followed it keenly as a sort of scientist.
Oh, brilliant. And do you have an environmental confession?
Yes, I have a sweet tooth. So I'm very partial to Alphonse sweet mangoes from Pakistan or India. And I realise they're imported, lots of air miles, but like mangoes, like sweet mango, mango lassi, like I love mangoes. And yeah, they're not grown in my back garden. So yeah, they are imported all the way for me.
Mango, I love that. Mango is your environmental confession. That's brilliant. Yeah. And Andy, please introduce yourself.
Hi, yeah, my name's Andy Field. I'm a stand-up comedian and a comedy writer. Nowhere near as qualified as anyone else here, and really excited. Yeah, I'm ready to learn something, if nothing else.
Brilliant. And talking about learning, when did you first learn about climate change?
I was thinking about this, and it's odd because, you know, I'm only 10 years older than Maya, but I don't remember it being talked about much at all. I mean, I think the main thing I remember hearing first was about the hole in the ozone layer. Everyone was really fired up about that hole. And there was a lot of talk about the hole, closing the hole, the hole's getting bigger. I wasn't 100% sure what the hole was, where it was, what it looked like. But I knew there was a hole that we'd caused. And then I feel like awareness of climate change and global warming sort of coincided with my kind of moody teen years. So I can't remember whether I was just saying, we're all doomed, we're all going to die anyway. But I think the seriousness of it kind of, yeah, it coincided with me being really, really gloomy anyway. So I can't pinpoint the point, but the ozone hole, oh, I remember that. I was fired up about that from an early age.
That was a big thing in your life. And what is your environmental confession? I'm assuming it's not aerosols then.
Oh, no. I mean, I've got loads. I'm a huge fan of cheese. I always try and be vegan, and my record is about a month. But I also have an issue of I'm already naturally, even on a fatty diet, a very thin man. I'm quite tall. I'm about 6'4". And I find if I don't sort of pair a vegan lifestyle with kind of like protein shakes, I just slowly start to wither. So I'm just trying to find the balance in my own life. But, you know, as we push forward and these foods get better and more diverse, it might be possible for me to do it without my ribs sticking out. But
yeah, most of the rest of us don't have that problem, and it would be probably good for us to be a bit more vegan. Anyway, so just bringing us to the sort of overall question, just to set the scene. So, term of global warming first introduced around 1975 when the US scientist Wallace Broecker published a paper using global warming. Before then, global warming, climate change, really low on the agenda. And in fact, I mean, my view is it was pretty low on the agenda till, as Andy pointed out, to really the early 1990s. And I think you'd be hard-pressed now, as Maya Rose said, to find anybody who doesn't know anything about it or hasn't heard anything about it and isn't aware of kind of the home truths of they're scary, the doomsday nature of it, the mass extinction, as the animals we love on David Attenborough shows being in major peril, rising sea levels, starving polar bears and melting ice caps. And it's a lot just for us, I would say. I mean, I do have to go and watch some really bad television every now and then just to take my mind off global warming. But how do we take this topic and really broach it with the next generation? Because Maya, you are part of the next generation, but there's a generation below you as well who will be coming up soon. Because it is pretty daunting, even if you're in it and trying to do something about it. I mean, where do we go with from that? Just to start with, Maya, you had a very different schooling system. Did you learn much at school about climate change or not?
It's actually really shocking because I first learned about climate change in school in like 2014, so when I was about 12. Yeah. And at the time, they were still teaching climate change as being one of the options for what was going on. The other one being like, this is something natural that just sort of happens to the planet and we just happen to be living through it. And that was only like 6 years ago. Yeah. And I think that there has been a shift since then. But genuinely, there were so many people that came away from school being like, yeah, maybe climate change is a thing, but maybe it isn't, which is really bad schooling looking back. That's like complete misinformation. It's really shocking.
That's bizarre.
It's interesting. I mean, Andy, you must have come across it. So you work for a big environmental organisation. Have you come across, you must have learned about climate change beforehand. I mean, you were talking about your gloom and doom as teenage years, but you must at some point started to see the science. Did it come through your comedy or where did you pick it up from?
I think it was definitely working for the environmental company. I mean, I just won't say their name because as a comedian, I always worry that I'm going to say something silly and then cause like ire to be poured on whoever I was working for at the time. But it definitely came from that. I mean, my role when I was working for them was talking to people through social media about the campaigns and the issues they were doing. Yeah. So obviously talking to people on the internet, anyone can talk to you, hundreds of people a day. You ended up having to be really, really well informed. And I think prior to that, I'd kind of been wandering around with a, this is really bad, we should do something about this, but mainly just saying it and then just continuing to drive to gigs. And then I built up a lot more of awareness of it and understanding. But I think it's the amount of people I spoke to who didn't necessarily believe it was happening, or there's all sorts of different ways to read figures and reports, or a lot of people just reading headlines, which are purposely made to get people to click on them and then actually elaborate on the point with more nuance. There was a lot of a lack of nuance from people. And I think, it's a really difficult thing to get the right message across because everyone has an idea about what's happening and not everyone has necessarily the correct idea or an idea that's pushing them in a useful direction.
And do you think you can use comedy to do that as well? I mean, have you used comedy in talking to people about climate change?
Definitely. Although the main bit of stand-up I was doing about the environment before everything shut down was just, I was mainly playing with the logic behind the kind of individualized responsibility of, you know, you personally causing damage to the environment and suggesting that following the same logic, we could murder people. And then getting into the really, if you murdered an older person, they've already done most of the polluting in their life. So that's not as valuable as murdering a child who could well have grown up to be a lorry driver. So mainly using the logic of these things to tease and upset people. But there's loads to be talked about. I mean, stand-up's a great thing. So anything you think or feel, you can find a way to say it in a humorous way and get your ideas across. Yeah. And it's very useful for environmentalism as well, because it makes it less boring and grating, and it makes it more digestible if not slightly unnecessarily edgy.
And I mean, edginess, Bobby, I mean, it's a bit tricky to use that level of edginess in a classroom, I'm assuming. But I mean, obviously the kids are interrupting your fractions when they want to talk about climate change, but do you give them space? Can you talk to them at all about this?
So firstly, I want to say I became a teacher. I changed careers. I used to work in investment banking as a trader for Lehman Brothers. Bad choice in bank.
They don't exist anymore, accountant. Do they?
No, they don't. They don't. And I was a chartered accountant, so if anyone needs a tax return...
Excellent. Brilliant.
I actually do need that, yeah.
Yeah, so there you go. Andy messaged me afterwards. But no, my role, I became a teacher in 2014, so I'm hoping that your lack of science education when you said 2014 when you first aware of it, don't blame it on my appearance in the teaching field. No, obviously, like, I think as a teacher, the pressure on you is to deliver the curriculum, the exam board's curriculum, yeah. Get through it. And then occasionally, I teach maths, and theory is about, learning about data, algebra, probability. Students will put their hand up and they'll ask a question that's off topic. And as a teacher, you have like two decisions. Is it one to say, shh, get on with the work, which is most of the time you do. But occasionally you do try and link it back. So I think it's using those, I think there's a cliche called teachable moments where kids have an interest. Just finding those moments where you can really get someone's attention. Yeah.
And Maya Rose, did you have a brilliant teacher like Bobby teaching you, who kind of inspired you in what you're doing today and sort of taught you about nature and climate change and the environment?
Yeah, I mean, I had loads of amazing teachers, especially in geography. I have to admit, none of my math teachers ever got on with me, which probably says more about me than the math teachers.
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, do we think that teachers really have the opportunity? I mean, I have to confess, I very briefly, Bobby, was a maths teacher and a physics teacher, actually. Yeah. And I taught people who were doing retakes. So most of the time it was about just having a conversation with them. Mm-hmm. So they didn't think that maths was something that came from another planet and that they could relate to somewhat. But are we giving teachers too much pressure here? Should they be expected to have to teach climate change and about the environment in school? Or is that something that actually parents should be doing at home?
So I do find there's an increased burden on what teachers are expected to do. We sort of said we're meant to look up, as a teacher now, I take on a lot of work about mental health, about ethics and things like bullying. So all these issues, which, again, when you become a teacher, most people become teachers because they love maths or they love English literature or they love music. So they want to convey their knowledge and passion for that particular subject. But at the same time, we do have to acknowledge that as teachers, we see children from the age of 5 to 18, depending on where you teach. And you've got this responsibility, not just to the students, but to society, to educate these young people. So it's trying to find like a balance, because again, as a teacher, I teach maths, but I also have a form class. As a form teacher, and this is a pastoral responsibility, and Maya Rose will probably recall her form teachers, they have the sort of leeway to discuss things that are the bigger picture, the bigger issues. So I think in those sort of roles, teachers actually can inform and educate children about things beyond just the subject.
So remember those tech issues I mentioned at the start? This is the moment right here. Thankfully, my panel are seasoned professionals and carried on whilst I changed computers, tried my luck in a few different locations in my house, and eventually found the sweet spot in the downstairs washroom. The joys of remote recording.
I love how, Bobby, you got half an opportunity and went, I'll host. That's fine.
Don't worry, I'll take over. I think with my students, I always find it's a case of giving them the facts, but presenting it in a hopeful manner. Because one of the things I find is some of my students will just come up to sort of, maybe it's a teenage phase, but they're like, oh, the world is doomed. It's all over. What can I do? No point in me studying for my exams. And of course, there is a grim reality of the world, but there are examples of hope from the past, and you can make a difference. I think when you empower people to think they can make a difference, then it's worthwhile. If it's just saying the world's going to end tomorrow, there's no point in having a big discussion. It's going to end. But if you tell them there's hope.
Yeah, hugely. And there is hope as well. You know, all young people growing up today are going to be the ones who have a say over whether this goes how it goes. You know, there's never been a more important series of generations, really, is there?
Hi, sorry about that.
Hey. Sorry.
Julie, we're fine without you. We're carrying on.
Bobby took over straight away. Don't worry about it.
No, I'm sure he's brilliant. I've got a relay, a router in the house. And anyway, I think it's the wind, personally. So talking about the classroom and empowering children to actually do things and think about climate change. Maya Rose, you were involved in the school strike movement, weren't you?
Yeah, I think most people my age have gotten involved in some shape or form.
Tell us how that came about. Was it just, did you find out about it through friends, or did you see it through social media? How did you get involved?
I still remember when the whole like Greta wave sort of swept through my generation because it was so exciting. Like, because like I said earlier, I've been doing this since I was like 11 or 12. So I was sort of doing climate change stuff while it was still slightly uncomfortable to talk about climate change that much. Like, it wasn't really a mainstream thing in the way it is now. And then suddenly it was like, yeah, the Greta impact, as people have called it. And it was one of those weird things where I don't think anyone like told me about it. People just knew that it was happening and it was fantastic. And it was like this whole generation that had been like galvanized to go and like protest out in the streets. And I think people were really surprised at the time. They're like, where has this come from? It felt very sudden, I think. But I think, I don't know, as a young person, it's so easy to feel like people don't want, well, because a lot of the time they don't want to listen, but it's so easy to feel like people don't want to listen, especially people in power, and something so clear coming along where you could use your voice and you could show, like, you know, governments and politicians that this was an issue you really cared about. That was something that was always, you know, attract loads of young people.
And I think what was amazing about it, for me anyhow, when I watched it, I just thought it did make a massive difference. It really, politicians, it did shift the political conversation. Although obviously we got quite a lot of sort of backlash against it from people saying they should all be at school. And Bobby, that must have been tricky for you, because obviously you're a teacher and you have to say kids have to go to school. I mean, you must have felt a little bit conflicted at this point. What do you...
Oh, yes. So I remember actually back in early 2019 when Greta was first emerging, I occasionally do newspaper reviews on BBC Breakfast on a Sunday or Saturday. And I picked this out as one of my stories, saying, oh, Greta's doing this climate strike. And then the presenter's like, who's Greta? And at the time, she was just someone emerging. And then they asked me, would you encourage your students to strike? And I think my view is, personally, as Bobby Seagull, the human, I'd be like, going, go on, students, strike, go on the streets, go and march for our rights. But as the maths teacher in school, where I want them to pass the exams, like, actually, can you strike in your holidays, in the half term, not when I'm teaching you? So I think it gives a sort of dichotomy in education where you want them to be educated so they've qualified so they can reach out into the world being sort of an articulate, literate, numerate person, which means they've got to be in school. But at the same time, you understand that change doesn't happen if you just follow the procedures. And when people, you know, again, change requires you to cause a bit of discomfort for other people.
Yeah.
So actually, Bobby Seagull, the person, is cheering. But Mr. Seagull, the teacher's like, no, Myros, get back in class.
No, Mr. Seagull, yeah. And obviously, one of the things that they were coming out was that actually climate change education should be on the school curriculum. I mean, that, and Andy, I mean, when you're working in the environmental organisation, you obviously join that as a kind of, I'm assuming relatively young, because you look pretty young still.
Yeah. My hair has aged me prematurely, but...
How did you feel when you were there, when you saw this wave of young people coming out? I mean, were you just infused by it? Or?
Oh, massively. There's always going to be a little bit of, you know, I think whenever there's a mass movement, I sort of want to be a slight part of it. If anyone's doing a march, I'm there. I remember the you know, tuition fee protests. That was great. We chucked a few fire extinguishers. I didn't. But, you know, I love a protest, is what I'm saying. Peaceful, ideally. But yeah, it was brilliant to see, because I also think that young people have a capacity to sort of cut through a lot of stuff. Like, I think as you get older, you become sort of slightly more jaded and disappointed, and you go like, you hear, oh, this thing's going terribly, and you're like, yeah, of course it is. This is going terribly as well, and so is that thing. But I think young people just saw quite clearly how much of an issue it was, and quite rightly went, we all need to do something about this. And there was just mass agreement, because it wasn't a complicated thing to agree on. And I think it needed almost young people to approach it without that kind of feeling of, oh, well, remember the last protest? They just didn't do anything. You've got to have that ambition to keep pushing things and to care. And I think the more young people care, the better, because those young people are going to grow into older people who are running businesses.
Yeah.
And those businesses need to be run sustainably. So it's... Yeah, it's hugely, hugely exciting.
Yeah, I remember getting into this and being actually blessed by being naive a little, because I think sometimes if you're too worldly wise, you always kind of consider that things can't be done. But if you come at it with a naivety and an enthusiasm, then it feels like things can actually change.
Yeah, exactly.
And we talked a lot about teachers and education and the role of teachers in education. Obviously, the other people who educate are the parents. I mean, Bobby, how do you interface with parents? I mean, what do you see their role as educating children? And should that start, do you now find kids who are bringing their climate knowledge into the classroom themselves? Because actually, their parents are taking quite a big role in this.
So I would say parents actually are the single biggest influence on children in their young lives. So as a teacher, we see them, yeah, Monday to Friday, 9 to 3, yeah. 9 to 3:30. But again, at home, you know, the kids are sort of influenced by what their parents watch, what their parents eat, what they discuss at the dinner table, their holidays, etc. They're often the times where you can tell, I almost think you can tell more about a child's results by meeting the parents than looking at the child's actual school reports. Because at parents' evening, when you meet them, you find some parents are really engaged with the child's education. And actually, just by that one meeting, you can say, I probably reckon that child's going to do well in school, be more engaged about social, environmental issues. So I think parental engagement is really the key to enabling young people to be more aware of things. So if the parents are like, it's not for me, it's not, you know, Mr. Siegel, you just do your job of teaching them Pythagoras theorem. If they're like that, then the kids don't have a chance. So the parents are more like, oh, where can maths lead you? Where can science lead you?
I think it's interesting what you're saying in terms of like parents being the biggest influence, just because I was chatting to someone from Newsround, like from CBBC, mm-hmm. and they'd done this big survey about eco-anxiety in like really young kids, like 7 to 14. Mm-hmm. And I think it was 4 out of 5 of these kids were suffering from really bad eco-anxiety that even their parents didn't really know about.
Oh.
So I think there's like a lot of external stuff that parents don't really realise, where the kids are just absorbing loads of stuff from the news. Because I think, I don't know, these days climate change is just so like unavoidable. Mm. Even if your parents don't particularly teach you about it, yeah, even when you're really young, you're going to be absorbing all of that information, even when it's really depressing.
Myros, is that social media? So yeah, your children with YouTube, Instagram, TikTok, no. Is that where they're getting the information from?
No, just from existing, from the news, yeah. From chatting to people. I don't even know. I don't really know how like 7-year-olds get their information these days.
It is stressful though. I remember not really knowing very much about climate change, but still when I was about 8 or 9, I remember having a panic attack because I really clearly for the first time realised I was going to die at some point. And I just absolutely had a break. I remember I was on the toilet crying and my mum had to come in. I didn't even need the toilet. I was just got really emotional and sat on the floor and I'd managed to get it out. But I mean, that's what kids are dealing with, isn't it? You know, you're born involuntarily and then you've just got to continue living as if you chose to. Very unfair. It's really hard to come to terms with, you know?
When did you have this Nietzschean existential angst, Andy? Was it in...
Honestly, I remember it really clearly. I must have been like 8 or 9 years old, but I just realised everyone dies one day. My parents are going to die one day. I'm going to die one day. And I must have been playing PlayStation 10 minutes earlier. It was a horrible turnaround, you know? And then add on to that, I didn't even know the world was falling apart. I thought that was relatively fine.
So that's one of the things about the environment. Because obviously, if you look at it from your micro perspective, like, oh, I'm going to die, if let's say I reach the average age of 90 in 60 years, why should I care about the world beyond 60 years? Like some of my students actually do ask me that. They're like, I'm a seagull, they're 12. If I die in 70 years, I don't care what happens to the world in the 22nd century. So like, what would you say to them? Why should they care? Because it's not them.
I mean, I think now more than ever, like the world that your kids are born into is different from the world that you were born into. And their kids are going to be born into a different world. You know, for most of the history of humans, You had kids and they grew up in the same world that you lived in. They hunted and gathered and farmed or whatever, and everything very much stayed in an equilibrium. But now, like, you know, I grew up without the internet or a phone, and now I've got constant fast internet in my pocket. And when my kids are grown up, they're going to have, you know, holographic nannies and things. And it's just incredibly important that they need to understand that things are changing. This is a huge time for change, which also causes the anxiety as well, doesn't it? You know, if you can feel comfortable and on a track and know where you're going to be in 10 years, you're much less worried. But if you think in 10 years, maybe, you know, your house will have flooded, you're having a nightmare. But they've just got to understand that it's a time where it's very important to have an understanding of the world.
I'm doing a part-time PhD and my research is about maths anxiety. So I wonder whether there's like an environmental anxiety When people wake up and they think, almost like they almost think about the impending doom of the world.
I do remember when I was like 13 or 14, and this was in school, so my poor teacher was like listening to the whole thing. But me and my friends were having like a very existential conversation about how like maybe it didn't matter if climate change happened because everything on the planet could just get wiped out. Humans could be gone. Everything we've done could be done. And we could just start from scratch. And that doesn't seem like a terrible thing. And I think as an angsty 13-year-old, that was so appealing. Just the thought of humanity being gone.
I walked past some kids in the park the other day. And they were talking to, and I just overheard one of them say, "What's worse, coronavirus or climate change?" I was just like, I swear I was playing with Pokemon cards at that point. I'd never had that conversation. That's terrifying.
Yeah, so what were the kids doing?
I didn't stick around for the answer, but presumably both.
were they doing a TikTok challenge, or were they actually genuinely having a look like a conversation?
No, they were on swings, actually. I had to run over because my dog always tries to get on swings with people, which is I think is very funny, but depending on the person on the swing.
But eco-anxiety, it is a very massive, real thing. And it's also used to try and stop education on climate change. I see it used as a sort of opposite positioning. But it is real. And one in five children report they have nightmares about climate change. I have a great friend whose son really suffered from it and couldn't sleep at all for weeks and didn't want to go to school. I mean, how do we cope with this? We're smart enough to know what direction things are going in, but how should we talk to children without scaring them? I mean, it is an adult problem, but I think we've all said we want our children to be empowered with this knowledge, but how do we do it so that we don't scare them off and make them terrified? Maya Rose, you're not a child, but obviously you're probably closer to being a child than the rest of us. What did you feel? Did you feel anxious when you were growing up with this information? How did you approach this?
I mean, I'm really lucky in general in terms of I've never dealt particularly with eco-anxiety, which I honestly think has stemmed from the fact that since I was very young, my parents have helped me do things. So when I was a kid, it was that very traditional style of environmentalism where we all made sure that we were recycling properly and made sure we were switching off the lights or tried to cycle places. And I think as a kid, just the little things like that were really reassuring because it's this massive issue that feels completely uncontrollable, and doing tiny things to regulate it in your own life, I think, is really comforting. And obviously, as I've gotten older, I've started to realize that maybe a lot of that wasn't necessarily helpful or didn't particularly have a massive impact or didn't particularly have an impact full stop on the climate crisis. But I know that for a lot of, not just children, for a lot of people, things like that are really important in order to feel like they're helping and they're doing the right thing.
And Andy, I mean, giving children small things to do so they don't feel anxious, but if those things are actually making a difference, do you think that's enough? I mean, walking that line between empowering and overwhelming, but also making sure we are doing something. I mean, do you think we get it right or not?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, at the environmental organisation I work for, we sort of refer to it sometimes as placebo activism.
Okay.
Whereby, you know, say we're trying to get plastics out of supermarkets or something.
Yeah.
And you'd talk to people and they'd say, well, you know, I'm trying to buy as little as possible and I'm recycling it. And then you'd say, well, you know, they're exporting the recycling to Malaysia. And they'd be like, oh, well, I disagree. I think it's good to give kids things to do. Of course, it's good to give kids things to do. But I think sometimes it's about just emphasizing that what needs to be done by other people, you know,
yeah.
As in what needs to be done by big businesses and governments to change things. Because as much as you and all of your friends may recycle, if they stopped making the plastic in the first place, you wouldn't need to. You know, we're being given jobs to do by irresponsible, you know, unsustainable practices sometimes.
So mass writings, getting all the kids to go and write to those businesses, is that a way forward?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely it is. Absolutely. Because also a lot of these companies will say, oh, well, you know, we'll make some changes, but we don't want to change it so much that shoppers stop coming. But to a certain extent, you need to change it. You know, if you need to make it worse, we didn't used to have self-checkout machines. Then you put them in and we just gradually learned how to use them because that's how things work.
Some of us did. Some of us are slightly struggling occasionally.
But, you know, if you made drastic changes to the way things worked, people would just eventually get used to them. But big businesses and corporations don't want to change in a way that might confuse or upset their customers. And I think that needs to change. I think the changes need to be more drastic. That was the main takeaway from working for a big environmental company.
So actually, as a teacher, I would say that with eco-anxiety, I think there's nothing wrong intrinsically about being anxious about the environment, because there is a real issue. You just have to look at the data on carbon dioxide. Was it parts per million emissions over the last, you know, thousands of years? It's since 1950, you've been like heading up almost exponentially. But the key thing, I think, is to give people some hope, saying actually we can do something about it. And sometimes it can be that placebo activism. I don't think there's anything, again, inherently wrong with placebo activism. It makes you feel as if you're doing something good. It sort of motivates you to keep educating yourself. Maybe you might join groups, activist groups. So actually I think the placebo bits can be good, but then young people need to see actually it can lead to something. Okay, maybe you make an individual change here, but what if we get a million people in London to change, or 10 million people in the country? So I think if young people can see there's a way out. So the anxiety in itself, sometimes, again, like, you know, before tests, I don't want to bring your memories back, but you know, before like school maths tests, did you feel nervous, guys?
Yeah, massively. Although yeah. I never expected to pass the test, so it was more just annoyance. Yeah.
But like, what I think is that a little bit of nervousness is good, because then you're like, okay, I need to make sure I've revised for the test. I'll go through my notes. I'll chat to my friends and make sure we've covered all the topics. And actually it can help you, spur you on to do well in your maths exams. But if you're too nervous and you're too anxious, you're not going to sleep all night. You wake up and start the exam, you might throw up at an exam, your hands are gibbering wreck, you're wobbling. Mm. So I think it's like finding that Goldilocks zone of eco-anxiety, yeah, where you're not... It's not like you have zero anxiety or you're like overwhelmed with anxiety. I'm trying to find that little optimum spot where you're like, I feel like I'm anxious enough, I want to do something.
Yeah. I was chatting to this woman who, like, she studies eco-anxiety in children. Like, that's the thing that she does. And she was saying that one thing that's really important is that they're making sure that eco-anxiety isn't going to be classed as like a mental illness or anything like that, specifically because having eco-anxiety is just a cultural anxiety from like existing, you know, in a world that's experienced climate change, acknowledges that there's something external going on and something really major that has to be dealt with, while the people that are pushing for eco-anxiety are registered as, you know, another anxiety that teenagers are experiencing and stuff like that, are basically taking away that external feature, and it could have really negative knock-on effects, which I just thought was really interesting in terms of, you know, acknowledging the tangible impact of climate change.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It is right about just balance, you know, because at the same time as you don't want all young people to grow up as shaking, nervous wrecks who are incapable of, you know, facing the day, it would be equally strange if young people were growing up totally fine with no concerns about the future, just thinking everything's ticking along nicely. I mean, if anything, I'd find that more terrifying, because this is, you know, this young generation may be growing up with so much pressure on their shoulders, but that is to an extent because there's pressure on their shoulders, you know. It needs to be dealt with, but it's about the balance, the Goldilocks zone, definitely.
It's quite interesting because we did ask this question on social media and sort of got quite a few responses, but there were a couple that stood out for me, which is quite a couple of environmentalists, particularly when they asked their children whether they were worried about anything, and basically they said no, because you've been banging on about it for about 20 years. So maybe that's the answer, is that all the parents need to become environmentalists and then their children just get bored of them, so they won't be as anxious about it.
Yeah, perfect. Well, you be more anxious than your children, and then by comparison they'll feel fine.
That is exactly it. I think that there was a lot of themes about it were coming through on the questions that were basically saying, well, why didn't you do anything about it, mum and dad, if you knew about it? Bobby, you've probably already spoken, because obviously I've been offline for quite a long time.
Co-host, yeah.
So I'm really sorry about that. Do you come across a lot of this amongst your kids at school? I mean, do they come in worried, or do they ring in sick because they're feeling so worried about things like this?
So, okay, children definitely do have anxieties. And sometimes they will take time off because they're feeling worried about life in general, or exam, or schools. Not specifically eco-anxiety, as it were, but I think obviously that they get the sense that things are going to be worse for them than it was for their parents and their grandparents. Because before the Industrial Revolution, again, I love history, and I don't teach it, but sometimes I have little chats with my students in the playground once I drive them away from talking about Fortnite. Get rid of the Fortnite conversations. That's a game, by the way.
You only talk to them once every 2 weeks.
So, like, Industrial Revolution to the 20th century, we saw, like, lifespans are getting longer, we were getting more productive, people seem to be getting happier, But now, younger people are looking at their future and thinking, actually, Am I going to live a worse life than my parents? Is my life expectation going to be lower? Am I going to have more unemployment? So actually, there's a general worry. And a part of that, the environmental worry does contribute towards that.
And I think, Myra, it's your point about just not making this a specific thing, a specific mental health issue, I think is so important. Because, I mean, my daughter is much more worried about the recent presidents and prime ministers that we've had, and her anxiety is linked to them far more highly than it is to specific eco issues. Although eco issues are up there, but she feels that it's somebody else's fault rather than something that is doom-laden. So one of the things we went out to social media, asked lots of questions, and I am going to select a few and then maybe fire them back at you to see what you might make of them if you were asked these around the breakfast table. I might do kind of three at once. So the first one I quite like was, if we don't turn the lights off, will the penguins die? Asking if all the walruses leaping off a cliff is our fault, and can you fix it? You can fix it, can't you, Mummy?
Progressively more depressing questions.
any offers for how to answer those as a parent on a Sunday morning breakfast?
Well, with the penguins, I suppose it would depend on how close the light is to the penguin and whether it's very hot. But I would imagine enough lights next to a penguin colony would gradually melt them away. But I would have thought the ones in your house are not that connected.
So the penguins aren't directly connected to our light bulbs, but maybe think about it a little. Bobby, what did you have for us?
Actually, on penguins, if you unwrap the chocolate bar and put it next to a heat, then it will melt. I assume they're talking about the 18 varieties that live in Antarctica.
I think especially the Antarctic ones.
We all think it's my favourite one. This is for University Challenge. Penguins often come up. So I've actually spent a lot of time Wikipedia-ing penguins, looking at like their deli, the chin strap, the emperor. So
why do they come up on University Challenge? Just
obviously, there's a quiz writer that maybe like once kidnapped a penguin from a zoo, or was abducted by one, has some sort of weird Stockholm syndrome relationship with a penguin. So it always comes up. So I would be very upset personally, because all this quiz knowledge about penguins would not be useful if penguins didn't exist.
True. But did they then ask a question about penguins, or did you just cram it really hard and now you're just inundated with penguin information and never actually had a practical purpose for it?
Well, you found one now, Bobby, because we've got it all on tape, so that's great.
Yeah, it's come to use.
And Myra's, you're probably a little way off being a mum yet, but what do you think? Do you think you can fix it, Mummy?
I'd say no, because I think she's a bit too busy looking after you, so she's going to delegate it. It's not that she doesn't have the knowledge, the skill set to solve our climate change issue. She's just a bit busy at the moment because you take up all her time.
Right, okay. So message to children, maybe take up a little less time and then Mummy might be able to fix the planet for you. So just to round things off, before we put you on the spot in terms of how to answer the question, do you think there is any benefit in not telling children about change in the environment generally? Bobby, what do you think? I mean, you deal with kids every day. Do you think it's a good thing not to tell them if it causes such anxiety?
I think it's trying to find a pragmatic, almost like that Goldilocks middle zone ground. Because if you over worry them, over concern them, they will, you know, when I say, let's have a look at some trigonometry now, they'll be like, no, sir, the planet's warming up. There's no point learning about the angles in a triangle. Whereas if you underwhelm them, and you sort of say, actually, it's not happening, then they're going to go out into the world and, you know, get the aerosol, start spraying it out, and they're going to start flying around the world just because they can and eating all these, like, Alphonse mangoes and demanding it from the most exotic part of the world. So it's trying to find that middle ground where they're like, there are some serious issues and we need to sort of find an action point, but they're not going to be so blasé. They're like, we can just do what we want. So, yes, make them feel concerned, but don't make them panic like penguins.
Okay. And Andy, I mean, you as a comedian, you put people on edge. That is the job of a comedian, to push people till they think quite hard. I mean, do you have many kids in your audiences and any experience? Do you think we should push them a little bit harder than we are?
I mean, in terms of kids in the audience, I don't advise it at all. Sometimes the parents have said, no, it's fine. And I'm like, all right, well, give it 10 minutes. And then they leave. But I mean, I'd be tempted just to tell them. But also, I think really, if we were going to approach this, this is an opportunity to set up some sort of a major reveal in the lives of children. So if we could somehow raise them completely unaware of it until the age of like 15, 16, and then, but they know there's a big reveal coming. There's going to be like an assembly with like a big thing where they tell everyone, then just all at once, you just lay out all of the facts and get them involved. That could at least be an opportunity for kids to grow up calm and then be driven into mania by such a bizarre reveal. Is that helpful? Does it benefit anyone? Maybe not, but it is theoretically something we could do. So worth thinking about.
Okay, I like that. Drive into mania by sort of taking them to a point of reveal.
Yeah, like the Matrix, you know, one of each pills. Maybe they can choose to be completely uninformed for the rest of their lives, and then the rest are like, you guys don't even know, you know? It'd be great. We'd start a civil war among children.
Matrix approach to education. Maya Rose, what do you think? Would you have wanted to have more pressure put on you as a kid, or do you think you had enough? And do we need to strike that balance or be a bit more pushy?
I think I agree with Bobby's like Goldilocks point, and that like even when parents think their kids don't know unless they tell them, their kids probably know, and so it's much better for their parents to sit down and have those conversations with them. But at the same time, it's a really massive thing and there's not really a lot you can do, and so I think there's a difference between like sketching out the broad details so that they have sort of a vague idea of what's going on versus being, you know, like the polar bears are dying, the penguins are going, we're losing our forest. You know, that's really dramatic for little kids. So yeah, I think you just have to balance it and feel it out. So I don't really know.
So we've got a balance of things here. The Goldilocks moment, I'm now going to call that forever. Thank you for that. And it's sort of being out there. I mean, I think having kids, you definitely, each child is different, and some of them are much more naive than others. So some of them, I think the big reveal would work, Andy, actually, because they go along happily, merrily. But some of them, they just wouldn't be happy with that. They'd find out way before. It's like finding out about the Tooth Fairy or whatever.
Well, the Tooth Fairy doesn't exist.
What have you done? Oh, you've ruined Bobby's life.
All these years of putting my teeth under the... I thought the tenor's just gone.
Oh, how did that not come up in University Challenge?
There you go. Anyway, thank you so much for being brilliant as a panel. And I'm now going to finally put you on your 20-second piece. So you get 20 seconds, we count you down, and we ask you the question. And Bobby, I'm going to start with you because you're on my top left. Do we need to be frank when talking to children about climate change in 20 seconds?
Okay, I've got to stopwatch. I'm a maths teacher. I'm going to go to the exact second. There we go. 3, 2, 1.
Go.
I think there is a moral duty to be frank about the causes and impacts of climate change to young people. But at the same time, this is coupled with a responsibility to show them that there is hope, that as a species that we have dealt with issues, like things like improving women's rights, improving racial inequalities. So as a species, if we put our minds together, we can deal with it.
Brilliant. How was that? Did you do it? Is he spot on? Oh my God, that's so good. Okay, Bobby, since you have shown such amazing skill and technique in terming yourself, may you time the other ones? Is that okay?
Okay, shall I count them down?
Yeah, so Maya Rose, we're going to put you on the spot next and Bobby's going to count you in.
Okay, and while in the last 3 seconds, I'll put my fingers up so you realise how time is down. Quite excited. It feels like I'm in a lesson now. Maya Rose. Okay, 3, 2, 1.
I think we absolutely have a responsibility to talk to our children about climate change and have honest conversations with them as well. But obviously it's an age thing. You educate them more as they get older. But obviously the biggest hope is that kids that are 4 years old at the moment won't have to deal with climate change by the time they're adults. Oh, I have more time, sorry.
Brilliant.
I was trying to be so smooth.
You were.
More my rose.
You were amazingly smooth and you nailed it in less than 20 seconds. So, hey, that's pretty cool. And finally, Andy. Bobby, you're going to count Andy in?
Yeah, okay. Ready, Andy?
Yeah, watch me ramble for 8 minutes.
We'll just mute him after that.
Yeah, absolutely. We should talk to young people about climate change, but it's just about couching it in the right way. You know, doom and gloom doesn't help kids at all, but an awareness that they're part of a generation with a really important job on their hands, not necessarily their personal job, but their collective job. And it's just, if they're going to do that job, they need to know it needs doing. So of course you've got to tell them.
There you go. Your countdown worked perfectly, Bobby. Yes.
Thank you, Bobby.
I might be a teacher.
Thank you so much for being an amazing panel and having a fantastic conversation about climate change.
Pleasure.
No, thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to Great Green Questions. If you like the show, then please rate and review and hit follow to never miss out on an episode. If you have a Great Green question of your own that you would like us to answer, please feel free to get in touch with me on Twitter @DavenportJulia or Insta @Davenport.Juliet. Thank you very much for listening. See you next week.